What is up, you loggerheads? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We're back with our monthly wild card episode where our motto is, just has to be better than nothing. And this week, Dan and I had we've been running around with this other event that we just did, and we have our Messenger Day coming up for the Seven Stages Shakespeare Company, which is we're going to do all eight history plays from sun up to sundown. Dan cutting the first four in that
in the Henriad
octology. Somebody correct me on that, and I'm doing the last four. But Dan and I haven't really had a chance to check in with each other as we finish up our cuts. So guess what, folks? Wild card.
Just better than nothing.
So enjoy as Dan and I basically have a meeting. I guess we'll actually also talk about stuff that we've learned about history plays.
That we've learned while doing our cuts, our various cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Here we go.
All right, so I guess that intro kind of left some open-ended questions. Dan, do you want to talk a little bit about what Messenger Day is in 60 seconds or less before we get to talking about the history plays?
Sure. So we are doing, we're doing Richard II, Henry IV, Part 1, Henry IV, Part 2, Henry V, Henry VI, Parts 1 through 3, and Richard III in consecutive order. The reason we're calling it Messenger Day is we've amalgamated all of the messengers and pages and servants that bring in news into one track. So in the great history of Topsy-Turvy, the messenger is actually the lead role on this day, as we see one human work their way through eight plays of battling and just bringing awful news to people.
As everyone dies around him.
Correct. So it's a celebration of the messenger and also all of the kings and queens and battles and lives that have been lost in one day, surrounded by beer and bold choices.
Mm-hmm. And so as one of the necessities of trying to do eight full-length Shakespeare plays in approximately 12 hours.
Right. Readings, not full productions.
Yes, I'm sorry, right, readings. So book, script in hand readings. One of the challenges is we're going to need to cut them down to a maximum of 90 minutes each, times eight.
Right.
And boy, are these plays thick. So Dan and I have been just taking the machete to these scripts to the point that we're beginning to feel guilty about the stuff that's coming out.
Yeah.
But also it's been a really interesting process because I think for both of us, we hadn't really dug into the histories in a very long time. Is that fair to say for you as well?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair to say.
So it's been fascinating to go back through and really dig in. So this is kind of our, how do we want to phrase what it's the other?
A little bit of what have we learned or what are we in the process of learning as we continue to work on these scripts?
Yeah.
In preparation for Messenger Day?
What you might be missing if you haven't really just gone elbows deep on Henry VI recently.
Right.
Basically.
Or things that were surprising, I think, along the way.
Yeah.
Because, I think we get caught up in the, we know the character of Henry V, we know the character of Richard III.
Mm-hmm. Richard II.
Richard II, you know, a little bit about, but there's a lot more to these structurally and relationship-wise that is being revealed as we work through them.
Yeah, so Dan, why don't you tell me, let's start with you, since you have the first, you have Richard II, Henry IV Part 1, Henry IV Part 2, Henry V.
Oh, right, yeah. So those are the ones I'm cutting. And then, Kev, you're cutting the sixes and
the back
the
nine.
Third.
Yeah.
One of the things I think that was surprising, all of the basics that we've talked about before in terms of some basic approaching techniques for approaching Shakespeare are super clear in the histories. And what I mean is like the billboarding, the names,
the locations. Have we talked about what billboarding is on this podcast?
We have.
Okay.
But just a reminder, that's when we take, you take something like the name of a character or the location that you are currently in, where characters walk in and like, oh, wait, so where are we now? Oh, we are at the shores of England. And you're like, oh, great. I'm glad you reminded me of that. And then they move into the scene, which is just letting the audience know.
Right.
Because, you know, they weren't changing the scenery.
Right. Well, Dan, here on No Holds Barred, those are the type of things that we learn every week.
That's right, Kevin. Thank you for sharing that with us on this episode, this wild card episode of No Holds Barred.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because, and I think that's a function of so many humans are coming in and out. And I'm sure, you know, these plays have dozens and dozens of characters each. Sometimes characters come on for one line and it's like, Warwick, how you doing? What's
right.
good? You know, and you're
right.
like, okay, bye.
There's even one, I think it is in Richard II, where one of the characters refers to one of Almeryl by his mother, calls him Almeryl, and the father is like, no, he's Rutland now.
And everybody following along, adjust
so you
your scorecards. It's like the umpire behind the plate with the big mouthpiece.
That's right.
Now batting for Almeryl, Rutland, number 6. So it's interesting that, you know, we're talking about all this plethora of characters who are coming through, you know, they show up for just one line, and it's, I think it's interesting, and, you know, as an ignorant American who threw off the yoke of colonial oppression in Boston in 1776, our English listeners can correct me if I'm being an idiot, which they probably should be doing anyways, but I feel like Shakespeare really goes out of his way to punch up the history lessons involved in this. Like, there are some scenes that dramaturgically, really, you don't need to introduce another character. And he'll have characters come on. Their character's name is evading me at the moment. But they basically say, oh, look, it's this guy and this guy. How are you doing? And the first guy is like, not great. My house burned to the ground in 1584, just south of blah, blah, blah. And the other guy's like, I also die later in this battle. And it's like, I feel like it's the equivalent of, you know, a documentary you'd watch in history class where it's just like facts.
Right.
Here are some facts. And it's, you know, the way, you know, we'll talk about Jack Cade dies in like a garden to this random peasant that they give a name to. And it's like, who cares that that guy is a guy? And it's like, well, I'm sure he was famous at the time. It's like,
right.
Who killed Jack Cade? Well, it was, his name's like Idol or something.
Got it. It's like the Cato Kalin comes in. And
totally. Like, yeah. It's all these random one-offs. And it's like, you know, it probably would have helped out your audience if you just condensed two of these lords into one lord and stopped having, you know, more names get billboarded out there.
Right.
But he seems very... It seems like a priority to him in a way that I didn't realize before to get the facts out there.
That's
did
really
you find that in your half too?
I did not. Actually, one of the things I wrote down was that these actually work as plays without a formal knowledge of English history.
Oh, and they do. And I only notice it in that I'm cutting.
I see.
So like, you know, when these two random guys walk in and they're like, I, of course, invented the cotton gin,
right.
You know, or whatever.
Eli Whitney, you're out of here.
In there. Yeah, sure. You know, it'd be the equivalent of, you know.
So are those things getting cut in your cuts? Or are they
they are absolutely getting cut. It would be like in Hamilton if, like, I mean, I know there's no place that you could squeeze in John Adams into Hamilton, but if, like.
They call him the guy without a job, don't they?
I can't even. You know, they mention Henry Knox. It'd be like if Henry Knox, who's a famous Revolutionary War general, popped in for 1 second and Hamilton was like, Henry Knox, what's going on? And he's like, I'm fat and just got back from Ticonderoga. Okay, bye. And it's like one line. So there's a lot of stuff like that. And guess what? English Henry Knox, you cut.
You're out of here. You gotta go.
but they still work as a play,
yeah.
Of course. But there are a lot of those things where it's like that character could just be Messenger 2. He doesn't need, they don't need to be like, oh, Sir Blah Blah.
Yes. That has definitely happened in the first half.
Okay.
There are several characters who are named characters who are now named Messenger, which has been fun to play with.
Absolutely.
One of the things I noticed, and this might incite some anger, but I don't, who cares? Get mad. I think that despite the number of battles in these plays, there's really not a lot of action.
How do you mean action?
There's a lot of traveling and a lot of talking about what has happened and what is about to happen, but not a lot happens on stage, at least in the first four. I feel like it's a lot of people. There's a lot of talking, and at great length. Like, it's been some of the easier stuff to cut compared to some of the other cuts we've had to do for this program. The problem has been in cutting things and then finding out a play and a half later, like, oh shoot,
oh wait, that's important. Back in. Yeah,
because it's gonna pay off in seven acts from now.
Right.
But there's just a lot of I feel like in these plays the currency is language. And the higher status character you are, the more currency you have. So you you get to speak. Like, they just have pages and pages. You're like, okay, sorry, leads. Your 2-page monologue is now a line.
Oh well, right. That's in this bare bones, merciless cut. This Cliffordian cut.
Here.
Well, that's interesting that you say that, because I think he makes up for that on the backside. Then.
Oh, interesting.
Because like. All of Henry VI, Part 3, is war. It's just war from nose to toes. Okay. Like, in between, I actually have, that was the next thing I wanted to talk about. There is an awful lot of battles in, really, Henry VI. I mean, in all the Henry VI's, he's just at war, because everybody sees a weakness in Henry, that it's the French in Henry VI, and then you have various revolutions, you have a peasant uprising, you have the Lancaster, the War of the Roses in Part 2 and 3. Basically, between every scene, it's like skirmish, re-enter, so-and-so, and they both threaten to kill each other, and even the truces last about less than an act until we introduce a new character who's like, I'm going to kill everybody. So maybe, I know that Shakespeare didn't write these in order, but spiritually he learned the lesson as he went through.
Right. Or they're like, there's too many battles.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, well, check this out.
Right. Here's some freaking battles. Although this, you know, in the nature of us debriefing about this, we're going to need to figure out a way to have just a ton of battles.
Oh, right. Then and in the vernacular of this program, how do we do
exactly.
that?
Right, exactly. Right.
It'll be fine.
So, yeah, it'll be great.
That's why I love Henry V, and the chorus comes out and is like, there's a battle scene coming up, and there's going to be like four actors with really bad swords doing this. Please forgive us.
Do we just do that at the top of every one of the eight?
Remember, no, the chorus just yells out, remember me, every time there's a battle. It's a Hamlet reference.
I got it.
Hamleton reference.
It's a real, what's the opposite of a deep cut? That's a real shallow cut.
I fought one off. So it's really interesting in thinking about battles and what people are battling for. And I know we've talked about the histories before, you know, they're all about the crown and the pursuit of the crown. One of the things I think I've realized, and this might be different too in the latter four, so I'm curious to hear your thoughts, but the first four are especially... They're centered around the pursuit of the crown, but they're very much plays about the people underneath the crown, much more than about kings. They're about all three kings that we meet are presented as completely fallible. Which is really interesting. I think I didn't really process that so much, how much they talk about their own fallibilities. Richard II absolutely is criticized for not, he's a wasteful king. Henry IV is a weak king at the end, where they're all concerned, like, oh, here he goes again, having his fits. And then Henry V, outside of Henry V, is just a basket case. And all of a sudden he's amazing.
Right.
For like two acts.
Right. In his prime, he peaks.
Yeah. Quickly gets married and dies.
Right. And in Henry VI, Henry VI is spineless, basically. He's very religious, he's soft, and everyone, I mean, in all the Henry VI, people are continually taking advantage of his nature, and comparing him to Henry. Basically, he gets a series of passes because he's Henry V's son. They're like, Henry V was so great, so we're going to give you a break on this one. And he's like, thanks, bye. And then, of course, Richard III is the best. So I think 7 of the 8 have an infallible king. Although even in Richard III, Edward is, you know, he's dying the whole time we see him.
Right.
You know, so no, it's definitely, there are no invincible kings except for a brief Pedro Martinez 1999-2000-esque two-act period for Henry V, I think.
Right. It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I guess, yeah, the other thing that you see when you have these characters, when it's not all about how great the kings are, all these other characters who are, I mean, to put it bluntly, are taking advantage of the weaknesses in the king, you see how great these other characters are.
Yeah.
And there are so many characters that I didn't really appreciate before, but the one that's really stuck out to me the most is Margaret for the back half.
Okay.
Who is in all 4. God, I hope she shows up. I think she's in Henry VI Part 1. If not, she's there early in Henry VI Part 2. But what an amazing... It's one of those things where there's... In each play, she's great, but when you look at the arc of all 4...
Yep.
It's probably... I mean, it could be the best female character in the canon.
Oh, wow.
But because of the way it's split up, like, I don't know if I saw Henry VI Part 2, I'd be like, oh, yeah, Margaret. It's like you need to see the whole arc of her as this, from this, like, 16-year-old being, you know, dowried off to, like, she takes over. Henry VI is like, I give up. And Margaret's like, I got this. And she goes out and she leads the army and she kicks the York's armies all over the field, and then Henry's like, we're winning, and she's like, get out of here, I got this, I do worse when you're around. And then culminating in Richard III, where she's like this crazy soothsayer, like, right. It's an unbelievable part, but it's so sad that unless you're doing all 4,
yeah,
you don't get to do it.
Right,
you know, which is fascinating. And there are, you know, there are a lot of characters like that,
yeah,
you know, as you go across, that it's like, well, if you're doing any one of these slices, it's not quite the same. But when you get to do the whole thing, it's awesome. It's awesome to look at it straight through.
Right. That's similar with Northumberland to a lesser degree, I think, in the first 4, where he doesn't really blow your mind in any of the plays. But when you see them all together, you're like, wait, he's still here?
Right.
Like, he's still right there, and he's not just like here, like in the play. He's right by the king's side.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever the king is,
mm-hmm.
Like, he's like, right. Hello, it's me.
Still here.
It's me, Northumberland, just chilling,
straight murdering.
So that's pretty sweet. One of the things I noticed in the first 4 is structurally early in the plays, you see the people that will end up fighting each other at the climax together.
Tell me more about that.
In Richard II, in the very first scene, you get Bolingbroke and Richard II conversing with each other. And Bolingbroke, who will be Henry IV,
mm-hmm.
is pleading for how much he loves the king. And he wants to basically slaughter this other man for treason, for speaking against the king. But as an audience, you know, like, oh, this is the guy that's going to usurp
right,
him,
right,
depose him. And he's like, in the first scene, pleading for his life to the king. Also in Henry V, you get Henry and the Dauphin together pretty early. Like, mm-hmm. right away, they're like, I mean, the Dauphin sends a message, Henry sends a message back, and then they're basically in the same room, stat.
Mm-hmm.
Also with, you've seen, well, no, Hal and Percy chase each other, but you get the people. It's not like, isn't in Creed, don't you get that? To bring it to another Shakespearean history play, Creed?
Yeah, what about it?
When you see the two people that are going to end up in the big battle right away, facing off, like they're in the same room. or they're being talked about in the same way?
No, yeah, in Creed they don't really, no, they don't meet until they're in the ring.
Who's one that knocks Creed out?
That's a different, that guy doesn't come back. He's the guy that knocks,
because he's gonna fight, right.
The guy that knocks Creed out, right, breaks his, or gets in the, I forget exactly what happens, but he's the one who loses his spot so that Creed can get in there.
Right. Anyway, they're in the same, Creed is not by Shakespeare. This is why, if Shakespeare wrote Creed, it would have been that guy.
It's loosely based on Shakespeare, but no, but that keeps happening. You know, there's this whole York and Somerset go after each other for like three plays about the War of the Roses, like, starts bubbling very early, like a play and a half before they actually like get to do it. And Henry VI is able to hold it together until France is put away. And then when France pushes England back into the sea, that's when the War of the Roses takes off. But those seeds are planted very early. And I think the only time, and then in Richard III, it's not that he doesn't come, you know, he doesn't run into Richmond until the very end.
Right. Yeah, that one's a twist. That's a twist because he doesn't, because that one's all about him becoming king.
Right.
Right, whereas
the other ones are about the maintenance of a king.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Okay.
So as we're talking about these characters, one of the other things that I've been, you know, all the lesser characters, it's funny, and I didn't double check the timeline, the actual Shakespeare writing timeline, but it's so clear the echoes of the characters in these history plays into the comedies and the tragedies. I would say more the tragedies, but like, so for example, there's a character, Gloucester, in Henry VI, part 1 and 2, who is the king's loyal, simple protector who believes that as long as he's good, nothing bad could ever happen to him, and he's true, and he's honorable, and he's just as honest as the day is long. And he absolutely gets ripped to shreds and, like, executed by all the guys. And even until the moment he's executed, he's like, I'm innocent, so I have nothing to worry about. And everyone on stage is like, oh, what an idiot. What a dumb this guy is. Right. And it's very similar to Gloucester in King Lear. The characters are very close. Or, you know, Margaret has a lot of monologues where she's out on the battlefield leading the troops, and Henry VI is like, I don't know about this. And Margaret's like, you need to suck it up and be a man if you're going to be the king. And it's like, oh, there's Lady Mac. Hi, Lady Mac. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
And then, you know, in Henry VI Part 2, there's this whole subplot with Jack Cade. It's the subplot that leads to the line, first thing we do, we kill all the lawyers, which you've probably seen on a t-shirt or a mug at some point in your life. Yeah. And the context of that is that all of the laymen, you know, the Dick the Butcher and the, you know, the, all the you know, mechanicals, for lack of a better word, are basically say anyone who can read, anyone who studied the law, they're gonna die because they just push paper around, and there's no way a piece of parchment is gonna hold my life in the balance. My fists and this gigantic axe are gonna hold my life in the balance. How about that?
Right.
But this band of mechanicals are like, and maybe it's just because Midsummer is on my mind, but they seem like the Nightmare Before Christmas Tim Burton evil version of the rude mechanicals from Midsummer, as they're like, just like, terrible, oh, well, we're news, just some simple guys. And Jack Cade is like, I'm the greatest in the world, and also murder, just straight murder of everyone.
So is Jack Cade Jack Skellington in this Nightmare Before Christmas?
Jack Skellington has more nuance. I would say Jack Cade is just, if bottom is bottom, then maybe he's the top. He's the Colosseum.
Okay. All right. You're the top.
Lines from that. Yeah, right.
Very nice.
So, yeah, just the idea that Shakespeare wrote these characters based on history, and then he's like, let's bring that on back.
Got it.
With a new coat of paint.
Right. Okay. Yeah, those tropes are there. And he's like, oh, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking a little bit about comedy. the comedies and tragedies. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that the characters appear more in the tragedies. But one thing I noticed about the comedy in the histories is that it also tends to be, for me, mostly verbal comedy.
The comic bits, right.
The comic bits are based in verbal comedy as opposed to comedy of situation they're in the first four, at least, the comedy is sparse. It's pretty heady. It's witty. It's wordplay as opposed to the lovers and mistaken identity and, slapstick. It's not slapstick at all. It's much more, I don't want to say highbrow because it's not that, but it's just, you have the dialect comedy with Llewellyn.
Sure.
And the Welshman and the Irishman. You get it. Hal and Falstaff. Falstaff turns a word on its head all the time. Ben's words sort of, like, he has so many monologues that take one word. And it's like, what does this word mean? Let's mm-hmm. break it down. How can I use it to my advantage? Mm-hmm. Where it's just so much more. Shakespeare knew he had his audience listening, mm-hmm. and that was how he chose to introduce comedy into the way. You really can't just throw. I mean, if you picture, if the histories are action movies, you can't suddenly have a slapstick scene in the middle of an action movie and have it be consistent.
Yeah, and I mean that is actually what kind of happens in the comic scenes that are just shoved into the middle of the plays on the backside.
There's
this whole scene with, I want to say the guy's name is Simcox, something like that. But there's this comic scene where this guy's like, oh, I heard the king is here. Like, literally, there's this battle where everyone dies. And then this woman runs up and she's like, my husband can see. And he comes in and he's like, I can see this victory. I regained my sight. I've been blind since birth. And the guy's like, how do we know that you can see? What color is my cloak? And he's like, it's red. And the guy's like, how do you know what red is, you idiot? Get out of here. And they run him out of town. But it's like just totally like a waka waka, ba 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 ba. And then like in the next scene, the child is murdered. And it's like Shakespeare must have just been at his desk like, I need a break from all this.
This is when you go get more beer.
Right.
Pee break.
And then there's a slap, right? It's the popcorn break. And then there's a slapstick moment. It's actually a bit I just showed you right before. There's a great Jack Cade bit in Henry VI Part 2. Probably the only legitimately funny moment that I've come across, other than Richard III, who is the best, where he comes in and he's like, I took this town that was, and as the heir of Mortimer, no one can call me Jack Cade anymore. I'm Jack Mortimer. And then a messenger comes in and he's like, Jack Cade! And he's like, and they kill him. And then the other guy, like Jack Cade's second, is like, well, that'll show him for not knowing. He had all sorts of warning to know that. But yeah, there's no room for comedy, really. And he still tries, right. Shakes still tries to shove it in.
Pass.
Yeah. And then the last thing that I have on my list is, oh God, Richard III is the best.
Oh, God.
When you get to see his arc in the earlier ones, like, he shows up in Henry VI Part 2, and everyone's like, you think we can take Henry? Maybe if we outflank him, maybe this, maybe that. Richard's like, I'm going to cut his goddamn head off. And every line he has, in every scene he's in, he is just badass as hell. And it's so awesome. And everybody's crapping on him for being disfigured. And in all the wars, they keep talking about how great he is in the wars. That, like, every time they're about to fall back, he's the one that steps up into the breach and is like, we're not done, let's go. And he turns it around. So the moral of the story is Richard III. I was unclear before if he's the best. And now I can confirm he is awesome.
Well, I guess my final point then to counter yours directly would have to be that Henry V is the best. And it's a nice redemption story of a man who is led astray by ill-influencing friends and then says, you know what? I got God on my side. Time to be the best. And then dies.
Okay. So,
and gets a French girl in the meantime, though, which is,
well, that's important.
Sweet. Pretty sweet.
Henry V, Richard III, give me a line on it.
For what kind
Heads
of line
up.
Are we talking about? Are they doing a
Heads
skin
up.
Game of golf?
Showtime pay-per-view war.
Henry the War?
I guess.
Like a boxing match? What boxing match? We talked about
Creed earlier. Single combat? Do we want to do single combat?
I think in a boxing match, Henry V knocks out Richard III in the sixth round.
No way. Richard III doesn't stay down.
Henry V. All right, well, Richard III is halfway to the mat.
What's the money line right now?
I think I'll win at the odds. Since he has been in France, I've been ever in practice. Is that the line? I don't know. It's from Hamilton.
Hamilton? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that'll be a future. There's a seed for a wild card episode.
It's a callback to a previous episode.
Is it? I edit and then I never think about it again. All right. Do you have anything else? Any other points? Anything else you've learned?
I learned that trios are a big deal, but that's not that important at this point.
At this point, do you mean at this time of night when we're recording this and are ready to stop recording?
Yeah.
Perfect. So I guess this seems like the best place for an organic plug for this project.
Yeah.
So this is going to be on Sunday, June 12th. If the sun is in the sky, we are performing, or if the sun is hidden behind clouds, we will be performing one of the 8 history plays in Northampton, New Hampshire, at the Throwback Brewery. You do need to reserve tickets. They're free, as all 7 Stages Shakespeare Company productions are free for all, or pay what you will. Those are all available at the 7 Stages website at the numeral 7stageshx.org. Dan, do you want to talk about Throwback a bit?
Absolutely. Throwback has been our sponsor for Shakespeareans now for the past 2 seasons. They are a fantastic brewery. They just got a farm last year where they are brewing. They are now brewing on site. They have a restaurant on site as well. Fantastic patio. Their approach to beer is not dissimilar to our approach to Shakespeare, which is why the partnership came to be in the first place. But they're doing radical things, really. They take beer passionately. They don't take it so seriously that they don't have fun with it. They do Afraid of the Dark series every winter. They did an oyster stout 1 year, which was mind-blowing.
They have a beet beer, which just lights my soul on fire as a child who grew up eating his Polish grandmother's beet soup, and then they made a beet beer, and I'm like, this is everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's so crisp, easy to drink in the summer. You just crush the beet. It's a beet wit. It's absolutely incredible.
You have to,
and then they have like the Dippity Doo. They have Love Me Long Time. They have if you want to have I want a cold, refreshing beer. They have that too. But they just do fun things.
What is the Love Me Long Time?
It's a Pilsner.
Got it.
So it's a really crisp, refreshing, easy to drink summer beer. I imagine that will be the beer I will be on
from 7 a.m. on.
I won't be because they're brewing a Shakespeare for this event.
Oh.
Based on some textual evidence from stuff we've pulled from the history cuts, as well as from the other plays as well. So they will be brewing a beer for this event, which is just, that speaks to who they are as artists and as artisans.
Artists, like, I think, is a good word, yeah.
Yeah, right? They're into it. They're into, let's play. What was Shakespeare doing? What was he drinking? Let's make that for the people who will be there. So if you can be there, come down and have a beer with us. If you can't be there that day and you're in the area, go to the Throwback and get a growler. And if you're far, far away, call a friend and be like, hey, get me a growler and mail it to me.
Mm-hmm.
Or email us. I'll mail you one if you pay us for it.
If you give me your credit card information.
And a small handle.
If you want to learn more about Throwback Brewery, their website is Throwback Brewery. That is throwbackbrewery.com. It has details on their farm, their beautiful farmhouse, their events that they have coming up. Blah blah blah.
Throwback also, they were with us from very early on. What, Richard III? They were integral in getting you in this company, Kev.
That is correct.
We hosted a Shakespearean's Encore when they were brewing beer out of... Their first spot was an extended storage unit, and they had the parking lot in front. They opened up for a Shakespeare in the parking lot when we did Richard III, right after they had found Richard III's body in a parking lot.
In the parking lot, yeah.
And we were like, hey, can we do Shakespeare in your parking lot and sell beer? And they were like, yes, which is what they say to pretty much everything that we offer them, which is what makes them so incredible.
Yes, absolutely. So please, if you're interested, find search for Seven Stages Shakespeare on Facebook. There you can find all the details to RSVP to come that day. If you can't make it, again, your support in terms of tweets, your moral support means a lot to us, as some of us will be up and drinking for 12 hours, and we've been preparing our whole lives for that, but it's still a challenge.
Yes.
And yeah, it's going to be great. Sunday, June 12th. Anything else for this week, Dan?
I don't think for this week. I think that we might probably come back on something. You'll hear more about this in the future episodes, yeah. I'm sure. As we tell you, oh, you know all the things we talked about? We learned that we were wrong.
We were wrong on all of that, yeah. So, yeah, thank you, Dan. Thank you, everyone else, for listening in on this meeting of the Midnight Society.
Right.
If you have feedback, you can find us on Twitter, at NoHoldsBarredCast. You can email us at NoHoldsBarredPodcast@gmail.com, or you can Facebook us at Facebook.com/NoHoldsBarredCast. So, woo! Until next time, my name is Kevin.
I am Dan. This is the wild card, so we're in prose. It does not scan, man.
I don't. Oh, that's prose that's going to confuse later.